You're listening to Talking Baseball with Ed Randall, presented by MLB.com. He's Ed Randall. He's talking baseball. What more do you need?
Hi, everybody. I'm Ed Randall, Big Ed and Nora's baby boy, and welcome back to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball. Our guest spent 35 of his 54 years in baseball with the Houston Astros as one of the most respected executives in baseball, first as general manager and eventually team president. In tribute to his service to the game, he is the namesake for one of the most unusual landscapes in the major leagues. Soon, they'll be saying he was the namesake of one of the most unusual landscapes in the major leagues. We welcome to the big show, Tal Smith.
Nice. Good morning, Ed. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Tal. Great to have you. When did you first hear that the Astros were considering doing something that many considered at the time to be radical with regard to the hill in center field?
Well, actually, Ed, I'm not sure it was meant as a tribute. I think they were looking more to deflect blame, if there was any. And obviously there has been some. But back in the design stages, when the club was moving from the Astrodome and building a new ballpark downtown, and obviously a lot of meetings, our owner at that time, Drayton McLean, convened several meetings of his senior staff and the architects and the engineers involved in the project. And after the basic footprint was more or less decided upon, they turned to me and he said, Tal, what can we do to make the ballpark more interesting than the playing field? And so I've been in the game a long time, and I've always been always enjoyed baseball history and reading about ballparks and other things. And I tried to bring the group up to date on some of the features of ballparks, the obvious ones like the vines at Wrigley Field and the Green Monster at Fenway and the monuments at Yankee Stadium. And then I talked about some of the other things and about Forbes Field, where it was very deep in center field. The batting cage was actually
exactly
stored in the playing field.
Amazing.
And I talked about Crosley Field and the terrace or the hill that they had, and also Fenway Park back in the days of Tris Speaker and Harry Hooper and Duffy Lewis and whatnot. And so that was something that was picked up on by the by some of the architects. And they sort of liked it. They built it into their original design or schematics, and why not? And I said, okay, well that's fine. I really didn't think it would survive. And on the initial renderings for the lack of some other term, when I suggested the hill, I didn't actually suggest it. I just sort of talked about features and ballparks.
Mm.
And why not? Then it was sort of labeled initially Tal's Hill, and as I said, the name stuck, I think, so they would know who to blame.
but you said just a moment ago you didn't think it would survive.
Well, because it was different, and it's easy for people to object or criticize something that's a little bit out of the ordinary. And I've always felt one of the interesting features about baseball is the fact that the parks are unique. The parks are different. We know that every football field is going to be 100 by 53, and basketball courts are standard size and so on. They all have their features from a standpoint of their names and the crowd and so on. But the playing dimensions are the same. So baseball, obviously, we go back to Ebbets Field and Polo Grounds and all kinds of unique situations. I had also mentioned one of the dirt strip between home plate and the pitcher's mound that used to be standard in every ballpark when I was growing up. Obviously, that goes back to the 1940s and 1950s, and that fell by the wayside. But in the original plans of the first sketches, they also incorporated that. And then Buck Showalter and the Diamondbacks sort of beat us to that. They opened their ballpark before we did, and they incorporated it there. So some of our people felt it was no longer unique, and that did fall by the wayside. But I was surprised that the hill survived. The flagpole, of course, in center field was also in play. Which also was a standard feature of ballparks of many years ago. And I actually got a call from the National League office shortly before we opened the new ballpark in 2000, and Katie Feeney, Chubb Feeney's daughter, who at that time was a key official in the National League, called after looking at the plan. She said, "Tal, you know the ball, your flagpole's in play," and I said, "Yeah, Katie, you've been to Detroit recently."
Right there, it was at Tiger Stadium on the field.
Right.
What do you recall your reaction was when you first actually laid eyes on it?
On the hill?
Yeah.
I thought it really it was an interesting feature. It really set the ballpark off very well. I also had a baseball reason for this. Because of our footprint and the Crawford boxes in left field, we knew that was going to be a short dimension, was going to be sort of a home run haven for hitters. And by the same token, right field, although a little bit longer, also had a very short wall or fence because we wanted spectators there to be able to grab home run balls and so on and so forth. So as said, left field and right field were going to be short, and I think you have to compensate for that, much like Yankee Stadium and Fenway Park and the Polo Grounds and Forbes Field and other ballparks did. You have to give pitchers some way to level the playing field, so to speak. That's a sort of an ironic term, but with center field being deep and having the embankment, I thought that was at least going to offset the flurry of home runs that that we actually did have in the opening season.
Tal Smith is with us, the father of Tal's Hill, and he'll be anxious to tell you he's the guy that they blame. The hill is modeled after, as you mentioned, the outfield slope at Old Crosley Field in Cincinnati. And this is a nod to nostalgia. And we're in a time, Tal, where there are so many idiosyncrasies in the game. In San Francisco, you've got the odd angles of right center field. In Minneapolis, a ball hit to right field could bounce off of four different kinds of surfaces. There's padding, there's limestone, there's concrete and wood. But nothing really matches Tal's Hill. It's sort of like you've brought a funhouse mirror element to the playing field with the embankment, at, I believe, 90 feet wide, a 30-degree slope, and a fence behind it that's 436 feet away from home plate at its farthest point, the deepest center field in the game, and, of course, as you mentioned, the flagpole. So this is really the place where home runs go to die and where the dignity of center fielders can be compromised.
Right, and I think it's really added a lot. I mean, if you look at a highlight reel of notable defensive plays in the ballpark in Houston over the last over the last 17 seasons, you're going to find most of them feature the hill. There have been memorable plays out there that I think have excited fans. Nobody's been hurt on the hill, despite some of the critics that felt we were endangering the lives of outfielders. I've actually seen more infielders trip over the pitcher's mound or over bullpens on the foul lines or tarps or things like that than I have in center field. There have been some center fielders fall down in most cases after making great catches, and I think it's less dangerous, frankly, than running into outfield walls.
Richie Sexson hit a ball on the flagpole in 2003 and settled for a triple. And I remember watching on TV back home in New York, Tal, Carlos Beltran, when he was with the Mets, playing the playing Tal's Hill and making a spectacular catch. There have been great plays made out there.
Oh, I think it's added a lot. I think it's really, I think for the most part, it's really been embraced as it stands by our fans. It gave a special identity to the ballpark, much like the Green Monster has it at Fenway and the Vines at Wrigley and the Monuments at Yankee Stadium and so on. And I think it was an interesting feature. It created real highlight plays. I don't know of any negative impact it had on the game. And most importantly, I think it sort of evened the playing field between pitchers and hitters. And I worry, it's not my problem, obviously, because I'm no longer associated with the club, but I worry what's going to happen here in 2017. As I said, left field with the Crawford boxes is very short. Right field is an easy home run distance. And now bringing center field in 30 feet and the power alleys, you really change the dimensions of the ballpark. When we first opened in 2000, it was a pitcher's nightmare until they learned how to adjust and compensate, much like pitchers have had to do in other ballparks, as I mentioned, that have been short down the lines and deep in center field. In 2000, I think there were something like 267 home runs hit at that time Enron Field, now Minute Maid Park, and I would not be surprised to see that number exceeded in 2017.
And now they're talking about 409 in center field, which is not short, but and of course they're going to replace the hill with field level seats, so the ball club will be maximizing their revenues by taking the hill out.
Yeah, I think these things, whenever there's a change in ownership, whether it's in baseball or any business, obviously changes are made. This is something they inherited. They don't have any pride of authorship in it, and why not? And as I said, they see a way perhaps to enhance revenues and so on, and put their own stamp on it. I think it's sort of sad. I don't like to see historical features in ballparks change much, and why not? But that just seems to be the trend.
What was your reaction when you heard that the ball club was literally leveling the playing field out in center field?
Well, I thought it was inevitable. I thought when the club was sold at the end of 2011, I really expected it to transpire, frankly, sooner than it did. They initially had plans to do it a year ago, and that was delayed for one reason or the other. So I've not been surprised. I expected it, again, because it's something they inherited, and I'm not sure they like the name either.
Are you saddened by it, though?
I'm sorry?
Are you saddened by it?
No, I wouldn't say saddened. I'll say saddened from a baseball standpoint because I like the feature. From a personal standpoint, no. I mean, I've been gone from the club for several years now, and you have to expect changes, and why not? I enjoyed it, and I think our fans did. And we'll see how it plays with the changes in the field dimension.
Tal Smith is.
These things happen at the time the club was sold at the end of 2011. The new ownership actually wanted to change the nickname of the club. These things happen in baseball, and I think that in itself is sad. I think clubs should capitalize on their history. And the great clubs in the game, the Yankees, the Cardinals, the Dodgers, the Red Sox, and they have a great history and great legacy, and they capitalize on it despite ownership changes. And I wish that was true for all clubs. I think it's important from the standpoint of your fans and wanted to recognize what they related to and what they were interested in. Just because there is new ownership does not necessarily mean that you have to remove all vestiges of everything that transpired before they took over.
You just mentioned something in passing I had never heard, Tal, that there was a talk about changing the name of the ball club?
Oh, yeah.
To what?
I don't know what they were going to do, but again, because ownership likes to put their own stamp on it, and whatnot, and that was something that was discussed. You know, and that's not the first. You know, I don't mean to imply that the Jim Crane and the current ownership that they're the only ones that have considered that. One, and I know it's been considered on and by other ownerships here in Houston over the years. And you know, and these things used to happen years ago. The Yankees weren't always the Yankees, and the Dodgers weren't always the Dodgers, and whatnot. But I you know, I do think it's important to capitalize on the history and the tradition of a franchise, and to do otherwise is sort of insulting to the fans that followed it in the earlier years.
Tal Smith is with us, the father of, I guess we should say now, the late Tal's Hill, which you will not see Tal very much alive, thank God, but the late Tal's Hill. And I'm speaking with a transformative figure in the game of baseball, because in preparing for this interview, I've learned, Tal, that you were truly ahead of your time. When you were the Houston Astros director of player personnel, you began accumulating and cataloging data around 1969 or 1970. This is long before we had the age of statistics just overwhelming the game.
Yeah, why not? You know, that's that was in the early days of computerization. I mean, actually, the when we started compiling data, it was in the old key punch days. I mean, it was a far cry from the technology we have today. But I thought it was important, and we did. As I said, I started that when I was vice president and director of player personnel back in the late 1960s, and we had a very good database, particularly on the amateur draft and amateur signings and whatnot, which I think was important. You know, from all measurements. I mean, from a standpoint of the characteristics of the players, their personal data, their age and height and weight and where they were from and school and all.
Yeah,
all
but you were also computing things like on base average and slugging percentage. These were things that weren't traditionally available at the time.
No, and we even after I went to the Yankees, we continued that not on the amateur scouting basis, but from a standpoint of major league performance. That was in the early days of salary arbitration, and clubs were focused on contract negotiations. And while I was in New York, I actually engaged a software company up there and worked with them and compiled data that we made available to all the major league clubs at that time, and featured a lot of things like on base average and various ratios and so on that are commonplace today, but in those days were relatively new. I mean, I would certainly submit that analytics are not necessarily new. They're more widely embraced today, and have developed to a much greater degree. But it's not something that was necessarily just discovered in the last 10 years or so.
But your statistical analysis wasn't just looking at players from afar. You were actually bringing those numbers into your own organization, questioning the ball club's evaluations,
right?
That sometimes the numbers would conflict with the scouting reports that you had.
Right. I think that's the value. I think that's the merit. I think you have to combine both the scouting assessment and the analytics and one of and I back in those days I would use the numbers to point out where perhaps there were additional questions or things that had to be looked at, and to try to find an answer. Well, why do the numbers suggest this in comparison to what the scouting reports say?
You had three stints with the Houston franchise, but you referenced earlier the Yankees, and you were interrupted in 1973 by a 22-month stint, almost 2 years, as the executive vice president of the Yankees that ended in 1975 when you came back to Houston as the general manager. And I'm wondering, did 22 months with George Steinbrenner seem like 22 years?
No, Ed, it was a memorable experience. There's nothing like the New York market, nothing like the Yankees with their great history and whatnot. I thoroughly enjoyed it. There were some moments that were more tense than others. George has been well documented and whatnot, but I have a great appreciation for my years there, and really enjoyed the opportunity. And the only reason I left the Yankees was because it provided an opportunity to come back to Houston, where I had spent 13 years, and to come back as a general manager. Aside from that, one of the New York experience I thought was great, and I enjoyed working with George and Gabe Paul and so on. We had our moments of disagreement and whatnot, but I always found that if you had something to back up your argument, you had a good chance of prevailing. And George was very, very competitive, very volatile. Everybody knows that, but to me, it was still a memorable experience and one that I enjoyed.
Very diplomatically said. But what I'd like to do, maybe on another podcast, and we'll do the podcast, will take 3 or 4 hours. You'll just tell us Steinbrenner stories for 3 or 4 hours. What do you think?
There are a lot of them, Ed.
There are a lot of them. I got to ask you this. There were times in your career where you were not treated with the proper respect. There's a story that you were on vacation in Hawaii watching your alma mater, Duke, play basketball, and you got let go.
Well, that was the end of my last tour with the Astros, when the club was sold, and the sale was consummated. At the time I was in Hawaii, I knew it was going to transpire, and I had tried to engage the new ownership in the meetings and discussions, and was not successful. They were not interested in having those discussions. I think they just wanted a clean house, and as is frequently the case with the new ownership, and put their own stamp on it. And I was actually in the airport lounge in as it stands in Honolulu, awaiting our flight back here, and when I started getting messages from friends, the media, as they generally do, they were on top of the story, and so as a result of that, I finally did get a call from George Postolis, who was operating at that time as the CEO of the franchise, had just taken over, and he did call to confirm that the reports were true, and I said, fine, I'll see you when I get back on tomorrow or something. So that's the way it came down. Those things happen, I guess, today because the media is so alert and on top of things. And I mean, we see this frequently in player trades and player releases and executive changes and coaching changes and so on, things that could be handled in a more diplomatic manner. Sometimes they leak and get out prematurely, and that makes it awkward.
But at the end of the day, what a baseball life you are having. I've had your son on this show, Randy, who is now in the unique position of scouting for a Japanese ball club, and you have left a tremendous legacy at 82 years old.
Well, it's been a great career. It's something I wanted to do from the time I was 7 years old. I wanted to be part of this grand game, and I've been very, very fortunate in the opportunities that I've had. We talked about Tal's Hill. One of the more memorable things I did, I took 2 years out of my player personnel life, so to speak, to oversee construction of the Astrodome, and that was a fascinating experience, and I just marvel at the opportunities that I have had.
What an honor to know you. Thank you, sir, for your time. So that'll do it for Tal Smith and myself on MLB.com. If you're on the move, thanks for the ride. And thanks for listening to Ed Randall's Talking Baseball.